Welcome back. I'm Sandeep Roy, and this is Your Call. It's our Friday Media Roundtable, the day we speak with reporters about the week's news and get your grades as well. What did you find covered well? What was covered badly? What was not covered at all? Healthcare certainly dominated the news hole this week. It occupied 80% of airtime on talk radio and cable news, according to the Pew Research Center. But how good was it about informing us about what was in the bill as opposed to how it was being passed? As the bill was being passed, an estimated 200,000 people were at the National Mall in Washington, D.C., demanding immigration reform. What kind of coverage did you read about that? I checked Google News that day, and the top three stories were healthcare passage, Tiger Woods coming back to golf, and there was one other sports story I can't remember. Alex Wayne reports from the belly of the beast covering health policy and Congress from Washington, D.C., and he joins us from D.C. Glad you could take the time on what I'm sure was a marathon week, Alex.
It was a little bit busy. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. This week, the community organizing group ACORN announced it was closing its doors. Its Washington, D.C. office has a for-lease sign. After two conservative activists participated in a sting, donations and funding to ACORN dried up. But did the New York Times get duped by the video itself? Brad Friedman, an investigative journalist and blogger who publishes the blog The Brad Blog, where he details his long exchanges with the New York Times, especially its public editor, Clark Hoyt. This Sunday, Hoyt will finally admit the Times made a mistake. But is it too little, too late? As ACORN CEO Bertha Lewis said, vindication on the facts does not pay bills. Brad Friedman joins us from Los Angeles. Welcome to the show, Brad.
Great to be here. Thanks for covering this important story.
Good to have you. And later on in the show, we'll be joined by Shireen Tadros. She's a field correspondent with Al Jazeera English, and we'll be talking to her about the continuing Israel-U.S. spat and how it's being viewed from over in the Middle East. But I wanted to invite you to join the conversation as well. How well-informed did you feel about the healthcare bill that did pass? Does the Israel-U.S. tiff feel like deja vu or something new? Do you think the media coverage is what really killed ACORN? What stories did you see reported well or not get the attention they deserved? Join the conversation, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can also send us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. As always, let's start with what was reported well. Let me go to you first, Brad.
Yeah, it's getting harder and harder to find what is reported well these days. But I was just covering a breaking news story yesterday from Clay County, Kentucky, where eight high-ranking election officials have been facing a trial and were found guilty yesterday of a massive election conspiracy. These election official insiders had been buying and selling votes in election after election, had been rigging the voting machines. While AP covered it as the convictions, as the jury found their guilty verdict last night, Bill Estep from the Lexington Herald Leader has really been all over this story. He's a local reporter. He's been all over the story for the past year, offering tremendous coverage of this broad conspiracy that has really racked this Clay County, Kentucky, this very rural, very Republican-leading county. He has done a terrific job. He jumped in with his coverage today, offers some real background on this story, a real look ahead at what may come from this verdict and the further prosecutions that may lie ahead. And so I want to give him credit as a local reporter, because he's really done a tremendous job whipping the pants off the few national journalists who have even bothered to cover this story.
And were these elections that were state elections or local elections or all kinds of elections?
Yeah, all kinds of elections, state, local, federal. And what's notable here is that in 2006, the most recent year that they were convicted of having rigged elections, they found a new way to do it, not just buying and selling votes as they had done previously, but actually using electronic voting machines to change the votes of voters after they had left the booth. And that's important, because the very same model of voting machine that they used in Clay County is actually used in 18 states across the country in total. So this is an important story. It's not just a local story in Clay County. It's one, frankly, that every state and every county ought to be looking at, because while 18 states use this exact model of machine, there are really every state in the union uses a similar type of touchscreen, if not made by ESNS, then made by another company. And it's this sort of thing that folks need to be looking at, that I've been yelling and screaming about for years, the dangers of electronic voting. And here's a story that really underscores the threat that these systems pose. And it ought to be covered nationally, but unfortunately, these stories seem to be covered as local stories.
Well, we'll see if the story does have legs, if any of those other states that are using it, somebody there feels like that this is something they need to start looking into. Thanks for bringing up that story. And let's go to you, Alex. What do you see?
Well, I wish I'd had time this week to read some cool local stories like that one. It sounds like a great story. You know, I guess last night I was reading, I think it was an AP report based on some Israeli media reports that the president had delivered quite a snub to Benjamin Netanyahu during his visit to the White House the other day. This is totally not related to anything I cover at all, but, you know, kind of I'm interested, like I think most Americans are, in the Israeli-Palestinian relationship. And the president basically rejected, it sounds like, Netanyahu's explanation of why the Israelis are building new houses in East Jerusalem. And a lot of the Israeli media are seeing it as a real snub and a weakening of the prime minister. So,
did you like the analysis that it offered?
It was interesting that it was based on Israeli media.
Mm-hmm.
I think American media have been trying to find out what happened in that meeting all week, and I haven't really seen any reports on that. I know neither the Israeli government nor the American government gave much of a readout on what happened, like you usually see after these kinds of things. So the analysis was that the U.S. doesn't generally stand up to Israel like this.
Right. Well, it'll be interesting. We're going to have Shireen Tadros from Al Jazeera English joining us later on in the show from Jerusalem. So it'll be very interesting to find out whether what the read was from over there about whether he did get a snub or did everybody play a sort of a scripted role. I want to also mention that we got an email from a listener, Art in San Francisco, who points out his two choices for the best journalism this week. One was yesterday's Fresh Air with Terry Gross, where she had an interview with the Southern Poverty Law Center's Mark Potok about the rapid, recent, and frightening growth of right-wing extremist groups in the U.S. And the other one also from NPR, from Morning Edition, where Ari Shapiro had a story called U.S. Drone Strikes Are Justified, Legal Advisor Says, that calls into question the U.S. policy of using drones for assassinating alleged terrorists in Afghanistan and other Middle East countries. We'll put links to those on our sites. And if you have a story you want to bring into the mix, we'd love to hear from you as well. But let's go to the discussion around healthcare. You know, I was at a panel last night, which was organized by the Society for Promotion of Journalism, and Oakland's Mayor Ron Dellums was on it. And he said, the press really started covering what was in the healthcare bill after it had passed. Is that a fair categorization, Alex?
There was a good story AP did earlier this week, reporting that this promise the president has been making that the bill would almost immediately end pre-existing conditions for children is not quite right. So, to some extent, that's fair. On the other hand, the bill that became law, is the Senate health care bill. And that piece of legislation has been publicly available since the beginning of December. Congressional Quarterly, my publication, we've thoroughly reported on its contents since December. I've seen reports in a lot of other media, including more. I mean, we're not exactly mainstream. We don't have a huge audience because we charge a lot for our publications, right, frankly. But I've seen pretty thorough reporting in other publications about what's in that bill. There's a great resource. The Kaiser Family Foundation has a free website people can go to that they have great explanatory materials on what's in the bill. So I don't think there are any big secrets in the legislation that are going to emerge. The AP story was an interesting look at how a provision could be interpreted differently than what everybody thinks it says, basically.
Well, Howard Kurtz, who is the media critic for Washington Post, wrote in his column, you know, that that this is largely a bum rap that the press failed to educate the public about the bill's sweeping changes, because he says for the media churned out endless reams of data and analysis that was available to anyone who bothered to look. But in the end, the subject may simply have been too dense for the media to fully digest.
I don't know if it was too dense for the media to digest. I think it was too dense for, well, I shouldn't say too dense for a lot of the public. I think it was too dense for a lot of the public to make the time to digest. You had to, if you really want to understand what's in this bill, you really needed to invest some time in doing your research and your homework and figuring it out. And us reporters who cover this have the time to do that because we're paid to do it. But your average reader probably doesn't want to or can't.
Well, we actually have a caller who wants to talk about healthcare. So let me try and get him on. Robert in San Francisco. Hi, Robert.
Oh, well, I didn't expect to be on so soon. I wanted to thank you, Mr. Roy, for your opening, describing how you saw very little news coming from the protests this past weekend, particularly in Washington. But I didn't either. I began to wonder if Google itself is, you know, has some algorithm that keeps them from reporting some things. But I just wanted to mention a news source that I have increasingly turned to because of its ability to clearly describe events today. I sort of think of it sort of as I once did the Christian Science Monitor, which had its own particular view of the world, but it didn't ever seem to...
Robert, what is the news source? We're going to have to go to a break soon, so
well,
I just want to get it out.
Mention, it is the World Socialist website, WSWS.org, and I think on healthcare, they pointed out something that I think was missing elsewhere. They pointed out that concession after concession to the Republican Party was said to be necessary in order to obtain bipartisan support for the health bill after it became clear that no Republican would support it. But rather than restoring the discarded provisions, which included assorted declarations of support for a public option designed to capture public support, new regressive measures entailing cuts to Medicare, the abandonment of poor women wanting abortion, and requirements that forced people to obtain insurance were added. And I believe this fraud was ultimately sold as a way to save Obama's presidency.
Well, thank you for bringing that point up, Robert. We appreciate it. Let me ask you, Brad, in terms of your blog, did you find healthcare a really difficult topic to cover?
No, not at all. It wasn't difficult, and I'm going to have to take exception with what Howard Kurtz reported, and respectful exception a little bit there with Alex, in that, you know, there's a difference between, you know, going out and finding places that discuss what is in the bill and what isn't in the bill and so forth, and the 24/7 wall-to-wall coverage we saw on the politics of the bill on virtually every cable channel, every mainstream media print outlet, broadcast outlet. They had no problem reporting the ins and outs of, you know, the political maneuvering that was going on. But as to the effect of the bill itself and how it would have affected the American people, that was the coverage that was sorely lacking. And, by the way, that was the coverage that, when it was lacking, led to the misguided opinions of many Americans about that bill. The media did not do their job.
Brad, hold that thought. That is Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. And we're also speaking with Alex Wayne from the Congressional Quarterly on our Friday Media Roundtable. What did you find the healthcare coverage to be dense? Did you find more coverage of the politics than what is actually in the bill? You can join the conversation with us after this break at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. We'll be back with the Media Roundtable after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW, San Francisco, your local public radio station. Coming up tonight at 7 o'clock, it's Left, Right, and Center with Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington, looking back at the week's news, followed by Counterspin at 7:30, My Word and My Music at 8, and Fascinating Rhythm at 9 o'clock. Among My Souvenirs tonight is the topic on Fascinating Rhythm. Stay tuned.
Welcome back. This is Your Call. I'm Sandeep Roy. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for a newsletter to find out what's coming up next. And speaking of what's coming up next, on Monday, we will have a conversation about the economy of the healthcare reform bill. How are you going to be impacted? What kind of coverage are you going to get? And how is it going to cost you? How much is it going to cost you if you're a small business? That's on Monday's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you. And today we are actually still talking about healthcare as part of our Friday media roundtable when we talk to journalists about the coverage of the week's news. And let me tell you who is on the roundtable with us. Alex Wayne is a journalist who covers health policy and the Congress for Congressional Quarterly. And he's joining us from Washington, D.C. And Brad Friedman, investigative journalist and blogger for bradblog.com. And we have a link to Brad's blog on our site. And you can see the exchanges he's had with the New York Times public editor Clark Hoyt about their coverage of the Acorn issue. And we'll be talking about that in a moment. Shireen Tadros from Al Jazeera English also is just joining us from Jerusalem. Shireen, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And we wanted to invite you to join the conversation as well. We were talking about healthcare reform. What kind of coverage did you see out there? Did you see coverage that made the issues clearer to you? Or was it more about, as our column mentioned, about the politics that went on behind the scene rather than what was actually in the bill? You can join the conversation at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can send us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Before we left off, Brad was talking about the coverage. And Alex, I wanted to get you to respond to Brad.
Well, I disagree with him. I mean, the politics is important, and it needs to be covered, in addition to the substance of the bill. If he's talking about just cable TV networks, then he might make a fair point that they do tend to focus exclusively. They don't have as much time or space as newspapers and magazines and websites do to explain the substance of a bill. So they do tend to focus more on process and politics and what's the news of the day and what's the kind of sexiest topic of the day. I'm not going to apologize for them for that. But if your listeners are getting all their news from cable news networks, then they're probably shorting themselves. I think you can get plenty of information on the substance of this bill in a wide variety of different media. Associated Press did a great job covering both the politics and the process and the substance of the bill. New York Times did likewise. The Washington Post did a fine job covering the substance, the politics, the process, all collectively. And you know, my publication did as well. And you know, to pat myself on the back a little bit.
Well, if I could just respond quickly to that I agree, Alex, of course, that the politics is important here, particularly on this story. But the notion that, this is a complicated story, so readers are going to have to go out there and make sense of it for themselves. Yeah, it is a complicated story, but that's the media's job to make it understandable. I saw this morning, for example, a headline talking about an insurance company who had turned down a newborn who had a heart condition based on the notion that he had a pre-existing condition. Now, these are the sorts of stories that, you know, take this very difficult bill and make it easy to understand exactly what the insurance companies are doing and need to be stopped from doing. And I don't have the resources myself to do a study across the media, but I hope that somebody looks at the volume of coverage on the politics itself, and you could even set aside the cable media, but the volume of coverage in the print media, in the online media and so forth, of the politics of it compared to the substance and compared to the way that it affects the American people, I'm confident that the graph would show a huge coverage of the politics, a tiny portion that actually covered the substance and how this bill will affect the American people, for good or bad, by the way.
Well, another point I think needs to be made here. I mean, once a media outlet writes about what's in the bill's not changing, but the political environment around the legislation is changing all the time. You have to cover those changes almost every day. The substance, once you've written about what's in the bill and how it would affect people, you don't really have to return to that subject, especially in the age of the Internet when anybody can go online and find those stories you wrote a month ago about the subject. I mean, there's no point in newspapers, and maybe you're not, this isn't what you intend to imply, but I don't think newspapers should be out there publishing essentially the same story every couple of weeks on what's in the bill. The bill doesn't change at a certain point.
Let me ask you one thing about the politics of it, though. President Obama just quietly, compared to the fanfare with which the health care bill was signed an executive order reaffirming a ban on federal funding for abortions under the new health care bill. And he had pledged to issue that order because he needed the votes of anti-abortion Democrats. And this was signed on Wednesday. It was an executive order. It was held behind closed doors with no media allowed to watch. How do you cover something like that, Alex?
We knew the signing was taking place. We knew what was in the executive order, and we knew who was at the bill signing, Bart Stupak and a few other guys. So the process of covering something like that is you talk to the people who were at the bill signing afterwards if you really want to write about the event itself. But we had pretty well covered that the fact that he was going to do this, the fact he was going to be behind closed doors, and what was in the executive order and what the executive order would do, which, frankly, isn't much.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go.
It wasn't much, and that was one of the issues. While the politics of Stupak and his holding up the legislation at various points for the abortion funding and so forth, when there actually wasn't any, was something that was really not covered well by the media. And the fact that, Rachel Maddow did a terrific job of covering it on MSNBC, but I saw very little coverage elsewhere pointing out the fact that there was not federal funding for abortion in this bill, in either of the bills, the House bill or the Senate bill. And again, that was a substantive issue that was not covered, and it allowed the bad guys out there to basically put out the notion that abortions were going to be funded by this federal legislation.
Again, I disagree. The entire abortion issue was almost central to passage of the bill, and it was very well covered by a lot of media that I read, including my own outlet. Again, just to state that there was no funding in the bill for abortion. I mean, you're correct. There wasn't a line item in the bill saying here's X billions of dollars to fund abortion and health plans, but there was a legitimate dispute between folks like Bart Stupak and more liberal Democrats over whether taxpayer-subsidized insurance plans would be able to cover abortion.
Let's actually bring another caller in who has been waiting patiently on the line, Sharon in Santa Cruz. Hi, Sharon.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have to agree. I mean, the subject of the type of coverage that the bill is all about has been lacking. I've heard a lot of fear, uncertainty, and doubt from both sides, but it's like I don't know how to evaluate it if I don't know what the facts are of the bill. And I think I agree with Brad in the fact that there's a lot of depth to the bill, and maybe we need to be able to break it down into individual items as far as ongoing reporting, so we can say, here's the information about funding on a particular health care, and here's an example of how this is going to impact you. But it's got to be in smaller doses so that we can listen to what that feature is and understand the implication to us without having to spend hours on the computer researching it.
Yeah, I think it could be told, the story, and I didn't get a chance to respond to Alex earlier on this, when you say the legislation doesn't change. Well, it may not change. You can report what's in the legislation, but the way it affects people every day, I mean, we're talking about millions and millions of Americans who are affected by this. Those stories could be told, those object lessons, those examples of what this really means to human beings. It's different to say, well, the bill does this, the bill does that. But when you put it into context so that America Americans can understand it. I mean, I suggest there's a reason why so many polls show that so many people misunderstand the bill, don't know what's in it, don't know what it does, don't know what the effects are of it, you know, believe that there are death panels, that it's going to kill granny, that there's abortion funding, and all of these things. It's not an accident. There is a reason, and I suspect it's because the media has not met its responsibility in explaining these admittedly difficult concepts to the American people.
Well, I'm going to put that question out to our audience. Do you think the media has not met its responsibility in explaining what's in the bill to viewers, readers, listeners like you? That was Brad Friedman, investigative journalist and blogger with the Brad blog. And we invite you to join our media roundtable. I'm going to switch gears a little bit right now and go to an international issue, a domestic international issue about U.S.-Israeli relations, which has been well covered in the media for the past couple of weeks, ever since Joe Biden went there and was startled to find the announcement about 1,600 new units being built or in occupied East Jerusalem. And Prime Minister Netanyahu came here for a visit, and which was allegedly about mending fences, but we're not sure how many fences did get mended as a result of that. And if you have been following that coverage, this would be a good time to call in and let us know, what do you think about the coverage that you've been seeing about U.S.-Israeli relations right now? You can join the conversation at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Let me bring you in, Shireen Tadros. How did the coverage look from over there?
Well, I can really speak for mainly the Israeli and the Hebrew press, and they tend to be pretty upset when there's somewhat of a media blackout like there was on Tuesday night when press people weren't allowed in to observe what was going on between Obama and Netanyahu. And it's been very, very critical over here of Netanyahu. There's this idea that Israel was humiliated in Washington, that Netanyahu basically walked into an American ambush that was set up by Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State, who tried to assure the Israelis that they were amongst friends, that this crisis was over. They were assured both in public and in private that this was going to be a good meeting between Obama and Netanyahu, and then he got smacked in the face on Tuesday night when he went in and was snubbed by the U.S. president. So that's generally how it's gone down here in Israel.
Well, I there was a quote in the Israeli newspaper Haaretz which said, the prime minister leaves America disgraced, isolated, and altogether weaker than when he came. Is the media more angry with the United States, or is it angry with Netanyahu?
I think it's confused about the United States and it's angry about Netanyahu. It's confused because every Israeli administration since the occupation of Jerusalem in 1967 has had the same view on Jerusalem, that construction in the eastern part continues, that it's the undivided capital of Israel. So why is it now that suddenly we're causing a fuss as if this is the first time or this is the first government that won't back down on this issue? It's angry at Netanyahu because it has come to a head, because every Israeli administration knows that this is always the elephant in the room when it comes to discussions between the Americans and the Israelis. But the Israeli administration's leaders have always been very clever about, you know, sort of brushing it aside. Netanyahu fell smack on his face and when Joe Biden was here, and this embarrassment was so big that the Americans can't ignore it anymore. So there's a lot of anger being directed at Netanyahu for allowing the situation to come to be.
Well, before you came on the show, Shireen, Alex Wayne, in fact, brought up the coverage of the U.S.-Israel issue as his pick of the story of the week. So, Alex, now that we have Shireen on, I wondered if you wanted to ask her something.
Gosh, put me on the spot here.
You're a reporter. Get used to it.
she answered. I think she kind of confirmed what I'd read earlier about the Israeli media kind of seeing this as a snub of Netanyahu. I kind of wonder where the relationship goes from here.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. It was always a war of words, so we were thinking that maybe it could be calmed down with words. But actuality, was it always, are they really coming to blows? That's the question. So right now we've had a series of inner cabinet meetings that are being held today and over the weekend and into Sunday. They're trying to come up with in the absence, basically, of any concessions on East Jerusalem, can Netanyahu bring forward some gestures towards the Palestinians? Because at the end of the day, I think that President Obama is very interested in results at this moment. He wants to move this very key cornerstone, if you like, of his foreign policy forward. So he wants talks, proximity talks, between the two sides. If Netanyahu can deliver on that, bring the Palestinians to the negotiating table without making any concessions on Jerusalem, that will be an ace in the hole.
Go ahead.
A question did occur to me. This is kind of just for my own edification, but I was wondering if the home building that the Israelis are doing in East Jerusalem violates some accord they had with the Palestinians. That's never been clear.
The which building? The building in East Jerusalem generally, or are you talking about a specific one?
I guess the homes that are building that are angering the U.S. right now.
There isn't. I mean, there's no agreement between the Palestinians and the Israelis, and there's actually no peace process to talk of. But what it does violate is every single international law, because under international law, you cannot settle your people, your civilian population, on occupied land. And the dispute is that Israel says that Jerusalem is annexed, not occupied. The international community, including the U.S., the Quartet, the EU, they all say no. 1967, Jerusalem was occupied, so thereby moving a population there is illegal.
Well, you know, Shireen, the New York Times reported it as Ramat Shlomo, a Jewish neighborhood in East Jerusalem. And referring to the first announcement during Biden's visit, AP reported to Pisgat Zev in East Jerusalem as a Jewish neighborhood in East Jerusalem. So it seems to be that there is a little bit of a paradox in terms of, you know, when the word illegal or occupied is being used.
No, it's not really a paradox. What it is that they're using the word neighborhood. We use the word settlement. But at the end of the day, there are many settlements in East Jerusalem. Ramat Shlomo is one of them. Pisgat Ze'ev is another. There's many others. There's dozens of them around. So the question is whether they're building new settlements in Arab neighborhoods like we saw happen the other day in Sheikh Jarrah, just as Netanyahu and Obama were meeting, or we're talking about expanding existing illegal settlements in East Jerusalem like Ramat Shlomo. It really goes down to the same thing. It's about increasing Jewish presence in East Jerusalem and diminishing Palestinian presence.
And as you said, there's nothing really new about Israel building these homes there. The controversy is less about the policy and more about the timing with which it was announced. I read reports that it's because Israel has this coalition government. Some of the coalition partners of Netanyahu were trying to, in a way, snub him and reduce his power while Biden was visiting. But even if Washington gave him a bit of a cold shoulder, in the end, you know, is it going to be just words? Is there going to be? Is the media thinking there would be action followed up from these words, or lack of words?
Almost for the first time that I've been covering this area, I feel that there's a little bit of a shift that actually Obama is looking for some kind of concession on Jerusalem. In the past, I would have definitely been told, you know, I think that this is just words. He's just trying to get as much possible, but there's going to be nothing said on Jerusalem. Palestinians don't share my optimism, to be honest with you. They think that whatever the determination that's being shown by Obama, at the end of the day, he has midterm elections, he has Afghanistan, Iraq, he has other issues on his plate. He's not going to push for Jerusalem. He's going to push for talks. And if talks happen without Jerusalem being discussed, all the better.
That's Shireen Tadros of Al Jazeera English. And do you see, for the first time, as Shireen is suggesting, a certain shift in the U.S.-Israeli relations and the coverage of it? We want to invite you to join the conversation at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. The three main stories we've been discussing today has been the coverage of the healthcare reform, the U.S.-Israeli relations, and we're going to be speaking also about the coverage of Acorn closing down and the New York Times and how it got duped, possibly, by the videos that were put out in the first place. And we wanted to invite you to join the conversation with us. So let's go to Reba in South San Francisco.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to get back to the healthcare subject. I recently read, I think it was the New York Times, where they were talking about how once false information is out there, the act of trying to refute the false information in fact solidifies it in the mind of the viewer or the reader. And so to some extent, I think it is very hard for the media to sort of get the right information out there when there is a lot of false information. But on the other hand, you know, I'm not a journalist, but it seems like journalists are supposed to put the facts out there and that they're not supposed to interpret them for the public. And I just wonder if, you know, maybe that line needs to be moved at a time like this, or just in general when people don't seem to be connecting the dots as much. And maybe the media needs to kind of take it further and, instead of just reporting the facts, also take it one step further and interpret it for people, so that, you know, these falsehoods are understood up front.
Well, thank you for that, Reba. I mean, I think this is this question about joining the dots is something that could apply to all the stories we're talking about today. But let me, who wants to jump in here, Brad?
I'll jump in. I'm not sure entirely where this notion comes from that, you know, the media is just supposed to report what folks are saying and then not report, you know, whether these folks are, you know, lying or not. We've gotten to this idea in this country, and it sort of comes from the right wing, the Fox News, the notion of, you know, fair and balanced. Every story has two sides that must be reported. Look, if it is sunny outside and everyone can go to their window and see that it's sunny outside, there's no reason to bring on somebody who says, well, on the other hand, this guy says it's raining. I mean, I think the media need to explain what is true and what is not true and not just give, you know, one side's opinion on something and the other side says, on the other hand, X. You know, I report quite a bit on electronic voting machines, for example. They've been easily hackable for years. One scientific report after another has shown as much. And yet, in almost every story you see in the mainstream media about the vulnerability of these voting systems, they go to the voting machine companies and they get a quote from them who say, you know, on the other hand, Diebold says our machines cannot be hacked. And then they leave that as the story. Well, the fact is, we know that they can be, and it doesn't matter that somebody who has an interest, you know, report what they say, but then report the facts. And, you know, the facts are demonstrable in many cases. In most cases, they can be shown who is telling the truth and who is not. And I see no reason why folks in the media can't report that. That doesn't make them biased. That makes them journalists, frankly.
Well, Shireen Tadros, doesn't it become much trickier to figure out, you know, what are the undisputable facts when you're dealing with something like politics in Israel-Palestinian issues?
Actually, I was just listening to him there thinking, you know, how spot on he is, especially with the, you know, the analogy of it when it's sunny outside. I mean, I totally agree. Sometimes there are, for example, this conflict is not balanced. It's the story of an occupied people and an occupation, an occupying force. And sometimes in our interest to get things balanced, we have, you know, the Israeli army say this, the Palestinian sources say this. Everything is lost in the detail and the actual truth doesn't come out. So I think what your guest was just saying there has, you know, resonates for a lot of different stories, not just on that particular one.
That's Shireen Tadros from Al Jazeera English. And if you, we wanted to invite you to join the conversation. What do you think about this notion of balance, the media's obsession about getting both sides of the issue and in the process losing something of the truth? So you can join the conversation at by email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Or you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. Did you think the media got the balance right when it came to the coverage of healthcare or the ongoing U.S.-Israeli relations? Or how much have you been seeing about the coverage of Acorn's downfall in the media? Join the conversation, 866-798-8255. Let's go to Ruth in Oakland. Hi, Ruth. Are you there? I think we might have lost Ruth. Ruth, you can call us back in, and we'll try and get you on. But Alex, let me get you to weigh in on this notion of I have to say from my studio right here, I have no idea whether it's sunny outside or cloudy. So I'm just going to believe whatever anybody tells me.
Well, I actually agree with Brad on this point. I think the media can do a better job at this, and I think we are starting to do a better job of this. A lot of the healthcare stories I read. I don't know if we make a call as often as folks like Brad would like us to do, like, you know, present both the one argument and the other argument, and then a third paragraph under that saying, well, so-and-so is correct and so-and-so is wrong. We don't do that kind of thing.
But do you think we should be?
I think we should. I think fact-check type articles are really useful, and there are some great publications out there that are now focused on just doing those types of stories, taking somebody's argument and just taking it apart and seeing if it's true and making a judgment. Those are really useful services. And I think, you know, the New York Times, the Washington Post, us, AP could do more of that. I do think that even the venerable AP, which used to be all about, you know, just the facts, ma'am, is doing a better job now of analysis and interpretation like the caller wants to see more of.
Well, speaking of fact-checking, let's move to the Acorn story. Brad, you've been going back and forth for a month with the New York how long has it been now?
At least 2 months.
2 months with the New York Times and its public editor, Clark Hoyt, about how it reported on the facts around Acorn and the Sting video. First, what has the New York Times admitted that it got wrong in the story?
Yeah, how it misreported on the facts. And I've been going back and forth with not just their public editor, Clark Hoyt, but also their senior editor for standards, who's responsible for corrections and errors at the paper, Greg Brock, both of whom essentially covered up months-long misreporting by the paper of record on this Acorn issue. They have finally now issued a partial correction, as of 2 days ago, this very same day that Acorn was forced to announce that they're going out of business, New York Times finally admitted that they got it wrong, that James O'Keefe, the fellow you saw in this 70s-era blaxploitation pimp getup in these Acorn hit videos on Fox News and so forth, that, in fact, he never actually wore that costume, that ridiculous gaudy guise, as the New York Times had called it, and many other outlets as well, when he went to secretly tape these Acorn workers and when they interviewed them and so forth. Now, that was put out front, that whole pimp outfit, as if to say, gosh, look how stupid these Acorn workers are. They don't even know that this skinny little 25-year-old white kid isn't actually a 70s-era blaxploitation pimp. How dumb could they be? They must be put out of business. And that was successful. They were put out of business. Now, this week, the New York Times finally admitted that though they had reported it over and over again, O'Keefe never dressed as this flamboyant pimp character in any of these meetings. However, they're still standing by the notion that he, quote, clearly represented himself as a pimp in these videotapes that were taken
and were
released.
Yeah, in fact, what they say is Acorn supporters appear to hope that the whole story will fall apart over the issue of what O'Keefe wore. If that was wrong, everything else must be wrong, and the record does not support them.
Well, I don't know where Hoyt got that idea that we're saying that if that was wrong, everything else must be wrong. What is wrong is that we don't know what happened in those offices, because James O'Keefe and his publisher, the right-wing media mogul Andrew Breitbart, both of whom have now been shown directly to have lied about this issue, they're the only ones that are being trusted here in this report, because they refuse for some reason to release the unedited videotapes, even now, 6 months later, after they put these things out there. Now, had somebody on the left put out tapes that were clearly found to have been at least a hoax in part, I can't believe the New York Times would continue to trust those people as their sources for their reporting. But that's exactly what the New York Times is doing as they continue to misreport this story. Look, I'm sure everybody remembers what happened to Dan Rather when these memos that he used were found to possibly be fraudulent. Nobody has ever shown for sure that they are. Nobody has shown that Dan Rather had any idea that they were fraudulent. And the White House, and these were the memos about George Bush's National Guard service or lack thereof, the White House at that time did not dispute the substance of Rather's report, yet the right had demanded that Dan Rather be fired, his producers be fired. There was a huge investigation. All of that happened. He was fired. based on the possibility that those memos could be fraudulent. Well, here we know that these videotapes were fraudulent. We know the people that put them out lied about them, and yet the New York Times, the paper of record, and many other media outlets, AP, NPR, CNN, and all the rest, are still trusting in O'Keefe and Breitbart's version of what happened here instead of bothering to investigate. And
now that Acorn has said, you know, even if it's vindicated, even if the Brooklyn District Attorney's investigation finds it wasn't at fault, it doesn't pay the bills. So Laura Flanders, in her column, said media bias killed Acorn. Would you agree that in the end that was the biggest, you know, it wasn't just they misrepresented it, but the media actually had a role in killing Acorn?
Well, when she says media bias, she's talking about, you know, whether the media would have reported it the same way had it been a hoax that had come from the left.
From Code Pink. In fact, Code Pink did have a hoax, fake press release in AIPAC's name calling for a complete freeze on Israeli settlements in the occupied territories. Nobody fell for that.
Well, that's right. And if they fell for it, I'm sure they issued corrections immediately, not 6 months later, not after all of the damage was done. The idea that there was bias, I just wanted to hit the nuance here, that the notion that there was bias might suggest that the New York Times and these other papers wanted to put Acorn out of business. I don't know whether they did or not. That could be a part of this. Certainly the excuses that Clark Hoyt, the public editor, and Greg Brock, the senior editor for Standards at the New York Times, gave are very, very troubling, because they simply don't make sense. They never did. And so you might wonder about their nefariousness here, but we don't have any evidence of that. We do have evidence, though, that they were certainly less skeptical of reports coming from these known right-wingers, these known hoaxers, than they would have been had the situation been reversed. And that's
have an email from Gio in San Francisco, and Gio says, Acorn was smeared and discredited by scammers aiming to defund the organization, dash its fortunes and credibility with Cook News, which went viral online through YouTube. Question is, do legit news operations face slander liability in a case such as this? Are the Times and other publishers liable for claims which may result from having joined in smearing Acorn and destroying its reputation? We are running out of time rapidly, and I wanted to get a couple of callers in, if we could, in the last few minutes. So let's go to Mo in San Francisco. Mo, if you could be brief, please.
Yes, I wanted to go back to the healthcare thing and to the Middle East, and I wondered if Shireen is still on the phone.
Shireen is still there.
How the Petraeus testimony before the Armed Services Committee and his briefing to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, how that's playing out in the Israeli press.
Thank you for that, Mo. Shireen? Hi, Shireen.
Hi, sorry, just cut out just for a second there. It's a very, very good question, because when the Petraeus information first hit the wires, it wasn't widely reported in Israel. And then when he started saying, no, that's not what I meant, and he retracted slightly, that's when we all started hearing about it, in terms of those of us who are watching the, you know, the Israeli TV stations, Israeli press and Hebrew press. I mean, they much prefer to talk about the fact that he didn't mean that it was such a security threat to have this illusion of Israel being such a good friend of the Americans, or rather not an illusion of reality. So it was definitely very interesting for us to watch how that evolved from our position here in Jerusalem.
Let's squeeze in one more caller, Craig in Oakland. Hi, Craig.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, you know, in terms of Acorn, I worked as a community organizer, and I saw that the people who work for Acorn, they work for incredibly low wages, and they put in long, long hours. I mean, these people are like, sort of like saints. You know, not villains. I think they'll be like the Joan of Arcs in the history books 50 years from now. You know, it's real tragedy what they're doing to them.
Well, thank you for that. And I wanted to just draw your attention to a piece that Rinku Sen did for Color Lines, where she said this is not about, you know, whether Acorn was good and bad, but it is, what is startling is how quickly a 40-year-old stalwart organization could be taken down with a flimsy, if concerted, right-wing smear campaign.
Yeah, this was a four-decade-old community organizing group that helped, you know, low-income people. It's an anti-poverty group. They provided incredible incredibly important services to some 400,000 member families in 75 cities, and they were targeted solely for the fact that they had the temerity to go out and legally register hundreds and thousands of low- and middle-income voters to participate in their democracy. Those low- and middle-income voters tended to vote Democratic, and that's why the right wing had to destroy them. That's
Brad,
it.
Brad,
that's all there is. Yeah.
Brad, I wanted to ask you, how did you first start thinking that maybe this video is not adding up?
Well, it actually was in a report quite clearly from former Massachusetts Attorney General Scott Harshbarger that was issued on December 7th, which out, you know, just came straight out and said that the videos were highly edited, they were heavily overdubbed, and that, in fact, though O'Keefe appeared in this ridiculous pimp costume in all of the videos, in every single office, he appeared in, he was a conservatively dressed college student in slacks and a shirt, and he was, you know, represented himself as this prostitute's boyfriend trying to save her from an abusive pimp who had tried to kill her and stalk her, etc. So that information was clear, and the New York Times never bothered once to report on that Scott Harshbarger report that came out December 7th last year. They didn't even mention it until this week when Clark Hoyt finally admitted that the Times got it wrong and that he got it wrong.
Well, thank you for bringing that up. We are going to be, and on that note, we are going to have to wrap up the hour. Thank you very much for joining us. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Thank you for joining us from Jerusalem, Shireen Tadros, correspondent with Al Jazeera English, and Alex Wayne with Congressional Quarterly. I hope you get a little bit of rest this week. Thank you.
Thanks.
I'm Sandeep Roy, and I will be back to tell you what's coming up on Monday. On the next Your Call, we'll look at what's in the bill that just passed and how it will affect the affordability of healthcare. What are your hopes during this wave of health reform? Join us live at 11 or send us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Where do you think health spending should be focused? Did Obama's bill get it right? On the next Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW and the friends of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or daily newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Maliha Razazan and Ali Butner produce the show. Matt Martin is executive producer, and Thomas Conchou is our intern. Pete Misek is our web editor. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Alan Farley is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.